Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Thursday, April 14th, 2005. With us is Robin Lamont, our LFO guru, and Kat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. Today we're going to be doing a public hearing on House Bill 5014, Department of Consumer and Business Services, their budget bill, and House Bill 5015, Department of Consumer and Business Service fee bill. Why don't we bring up to the table Corey and Greg and kick it off for the first 30 minutes. Oh, and I apologize. Come on up.
Christina's here.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, or afternoon, rather, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm going to let our budget and management representative to my left introduce herself, sitting in for Satish.
I'm Christina Shearer, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I'm going to fill in for Satish Padier today.
And, Mr. Chair, just briefly, I know your time is tight today. Our primary focus today is going to be on our fee bill. I did want to mention, though, that there were some questions that you had on Tuesday that we weren't able to answer on the spot. So we have prepared written responses to those, and I believe those have been distributed to you. Our fee bill, I'm going to ask each of the administrators of the divisions involved to give you an overview of the fees involved. But before we get into that, I just wanted to start with a couple of brief opening remarks about how we look at fees. And as you know from our previous testimony, the department is funded primarily by fees. We have over 500 different fees paid by the industries that we regulate. Each of our programs is supported by fees that are dedicated to that program. And we work very closely with stakeholders in setting program levels and setting the levels of our fees. We are, of course, a consumer protection agency, but we believe also in ensuring the vitality of the industries that we regulate, so we do regard that as an important collaborative relationship. And generally speaking, our philosophy is that our primary job is to carry out the statutory mission and the statutory functions which you, the legislature, have assigned us, but to do so in a way that's as cost-effective as possible. So we are continually looking for ways to deliver our services and to perform our functions in a way that is cost-effective, and where we can, we reduce fees. We never start from the assumption that because we have the revenues, we're going to spend them. We never start from the assumption that we're going to raise fees. We actually start from the opposite. When we can lower fees, we do, and we do our darndest to manage within the revenues that we have. But nevertheless, there are situations where we look at the revenues that are available in a particular program under our existing fee structure. We look at the statutory obligations that you've assigned to us. We figure out how it is that we could match the program to the revenues, and we say we don't think this, in fact, is sufficient to carry out our mission. And in that case, we do consider a fee increase. We work with stakeholders, and you're going to hear from our administrators on the specifics of each of the individual proposals in front of you. We're going to start with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'd ask Floyd to come up and join me. Floyd Lanter is the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and there are fees in three of his program areas. You may recall that on Tuesday we didn't spend a lot of time on the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. They do have a wide variety of programs ranging from the depository institutions like banks and credit unions to a range of non-depository programs, three of which are involved in this fee bill. The mortgage lender program, that, as you probably recall, we gave you some examples of the deliverables in that program. We had a recent situation where we spent quite a bit of enforcement resources working with law enforcement to close down some fraudulent activity that was aimed at Hispanic home buyers. Another program in this area that you'll be hearing about is consumer finance. That's the payday and title lending, as well as conventional consumer finance. And the third is pre-need funeral trusts. Again, I think we mentioned during our phase one hearing some of the recent activity in Eugene in that area where we did, in fact, have a situation where we had to intervene to protect consumers and their money. So unless there are preliminary questions, what I'd like to do is turn this over to Floyd Lanter to talk about his portion of the fee bill, and then we'll proceed through the remainder of it.
Please continue.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Thank you for allowing me to be here this afternoon to provide a foundation for the division's proposed fee bill request. House Bill 5015 impacts three areas within the division's finance section, non-depository programs. These are our mortgage lending program, our consumer finance program, and the pre-need program. The mortgage lender and consumer finance programs have experienced quarterly operating deficits since their fees were reduced by 50% in October of 2000. That was a strategic decision to manage down existing fund balances. As such, existing fund balances for these two programs have been used since that time as a revenue source to fund program operations and achieve compliance with the agency's financial management policy. The pre-need program was transferred to the division from the Secretary of State's office in 2001, and although administered on a part-time basis, has never been self-sustaining. The mortgage lender program fees, as I indicated, were temporarily reduced in 2000 to allow for the management down of that ending fund balance and bring it into line with the department's guidelines. Fees were restored in January of 2004 to the pre-existing level with the understanding that the ending fund balances would continue to be drawn down and that a fee study in combination with a review of the mortgage lender program would establish fees that would more accurately reflect the agency's actual cost of mortgage lending regulation. The division has worked closely with stakeholders in the mortgage lending industry to identify the level of regulation that best serves Oregon by protecting consumers and supporting legitimate mortgage professionals. Considerable time was spent with stakeholder groups to identify the most effective level of regulation. Members of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, this is the association that represents mortgage brokers, and the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, this is the association that represents mortgage bankers, participated in the program review process and identified the level of regulation that they felt was, at a minimum, necessary to ensure the integrity of the industry and the effectiveness of the agency's oversight. Based upon continued growth and increase in program responsibility, particularly with respect to loan originators, combined with the desire by the industry for more on-site examinations and enforcement action, the division and stakeholders agreed that the desired level of regulation in terms of positions and functions would ensure timely review of license applications, timely response to public and industry inquiries for information and assistance, a more effective and responsive examination program, continuation of an aggressive enforcement program, and the continuation of our consumer outreach and education program. In May of 2004, we analyzed what the mortgage lending program would look like given our existing revenue base.
Thank you.
The program will effectively be reduced to a licensing function only. This would not allow us to respond to consumer or industry issues and complaints or provide any examination activity, thus limiting our ability to protect consumers. For example, the program's functions resulted in a significant outcome for victims of a housing scam in Yamhill County in 2004 that left more than 100 Hispanic victims in various stages of economic and emotional ruin. In this case, the division participated in a multi-jurisdiction task force that processed complaints, which resulted in an investigation, criminal indictments, and some court-ordered restitution. More significantly, the activity raised the level of consumer awareness to predatory lending practices, particularly in the Hispanic community, which resulted in additional victims coming forward. Mortgage lending activity has increased dramatically over the last several years, fueled in part by historic low interest rates and record home ownership. And as you know, buying a home is the biggest financial transactions for most Oregonians. Protecting that opportunity or fostering home ownership is one of our most important regulatory functions. With the fee increase, the program will maintain its existing level of customer service for licensing, loan originator tracking or record keeping, complaint and inquiry resolution, on-site examination activity, and investigation and enforcement activity as dictated by industry findings and conditions. With respect to consumer finance, in analyzing the consumer finance program in light of our existing revenue base, mail-in reports will be filed by licensees consisting of largely unverified financial data in order to satisfy minimum statutory requirements. Application processing times will lengthen due to the continued volume of new entrants into this industry. As an example, we have 57 new consumer finance licensees since the first of the year in this program. On-site exams will be conducted.
Really quick, we have a question from Representative Richardson.
The question I have is, relates to the fact that you're dealing with highly sophisticated people. Okay, these are very technologically savvy people who I'm sure, for the most part, use computers and email and so forth in their work. Is there the ability for you to increase the use of electronic transmission of data, information, and so forth to save some of the time and effort that that is presently being done by mailing forms and data?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, thank you for asking that question. In fact, the mortgage lending area was the first program to be part of a pilot project with the Department of Administrative Services to provide for electronic licensing and renewals. And that program goes back several years now. And the most recent data that I have for 2005, 75% of the industry folks that licensed with us this year did so electronically. With respect to consumer finance and pre-needs, which I'll talk about in a minute, both of these programs are have been part of a rollout of what's known as License 2000. That's a statewide licensing application that is available, which the department is utilizing in the building codes area and in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And while it was just initiated here in January of 2005, I anticipate that further efficiencies will be gained through technology advances in this area.
Hello? Please. As you rely more and more and have the benefits of online filing and so forth, will that have an effect on your need for FTEs or positions?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, it's a tough question to answer. In some cases, I could say yes. In some cases, I'm not sure because, again, in the consumer finance and pre-needs, it was just started. But let me give you an example. In our securities area, which is not a question here today, we most of our licensing is electronic and is the registration of securities offerings issued here in Oregon. And through that process, we've been able to reduce at least one position in the past year. Granted, productivity can be difficult to achieve, but, you know, we're optimistic that through technology and continuing involvement of our electronic licensing processes, yes, we will achieve some of that.
One final comment. You know, in private practice, like in a law firm, when I started 25 years ago, you had two support staff for an attorney, and now you have two attorneys per support staff because of the changes in technology. And I'm just wondering if in your department you also are seeing this utilization at a point that really makes a difference to the taxpayer.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I see that trend evolving. I certainly do. And in fact, the majority of the division staff are professionals, not support people. We have very few support people in the division. And I see that improving further in the future. As I mentioned, the one position that I refer to in the securities area was a support position.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, if I could expand on that. That was a reduction in one position so that the program was reduced from 2 to 1. So that was actually a 50% reduction in FTE count in that program. We're not dealing with many, many people in each area.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Let's see. I was talking about consumer finance. Application processing times would lengthen due to the continued volume of new entrants into this industry. On-site exams will be conducted when a review of information mailed in or consumer complaint activity or severity so warrants. Enforcement activities will address the most severe violations after confirmation of on-site exams. As an example of what the consumer finance program provides, through these activities in 2004, we were able to obtain restitution of $285,000 for Oregon consumers. We received very few complaints from consumers in this area. However, the findings leading to this restitution were documented through our on-site examination program. With the fee increase, the program would continue its existing level of customer service with respect to licensing, on-site examination activity, and enforcement activities. The business case for this increase was a component of our program review of the payday lending area in 2004, which was conducted with stakeholder participation. Stakeholders expressed support for the increase during the course of the program review and again during the public hearing process held in October. With respect to the last program, pre-needs, our analysis of the pre-need program revenue base concluded that the program would be comprised of desk reviews that rely on unverified stakeholder-provided financial and other reports and would focus on trends and anomalies. On-site examination of pre-need plans, endowment care, and master trustees will be for cause for those providers showing financial weaknesses, new or inexperienced operations, and complaints that cannot be reconciled informally. With the increase, the program would provide for current level of customer service for licensing, examination, and enforcement activity as required. An example of these activities and their outcomes provided by this program include the license revocation of a Eugene-based provider in 2004, charged with violating more than a dozen state laws relating to the mishandling of pre-need funeral plan trust funds, use of illegal contracts, and failing to follow reporting requirements. Over $150,000 in misplaced funds have been restored in this case, and 19 consumers who sought cancellation and repayment of their plans were accommodated. In summary, these additional revenues are paid by the impacted industries. We're very sensitive to the impact of the fee increases on the vitality of our stakeholders' business climate. And as Director Streisinger mentioned on Tuesday, we would prefer, and again today actually, we would prefer not to raise any fees. DISCUS works hard to establish and maintain excellent working relationships with industry representatives. That effort is made easier because DISCUS is fortunate to work with stakeholder groups who support regulation that eliminate opportunities for predatory or unethical practices and support businesses who work in partnership to protect Oregon consumers. The Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon, the Consumer Lending Alliance, and the Alderworks Group represent industries impacted by the proposed fee increases. All of these entities have provided letters of support, which have been provided to the committee. The division is proud of these important and productive relationships and pleased that the industry values the regulatory work of the division. Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions, Mr. Chairman. Number one, on your bill, this is House Bill 5015, right? I'm not sure that I understand the way the bill is written. It has these base fees. Is this these numbers added to what's already being paid? Is this the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, these are the total fees, not the add-on fees. The structure of the bill, I might ask Ms. Lamont to respond to.
Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, if I understand your question, you are asking what these dollar amounts represent.
Right. What do they mean?
Is it a cumulative, right, or is it an adjustment? And it's my understanding it's the cumulative number. And I have asked prior to work session that we have a table that shows what the current fee is, what the proposed adjustment will be that leads us to these numbers.
Exactly. I mean, they're meaningless to me if I don't know what it is. For instance, I have a letter here, Northwest Professional Employer Association, that they are supporting your proposal to increase the biannual licensing fee from $1,250 to $2,050.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that is the worker leasing program, which we'll be talking about in a moment, which is actually an amendment to the bill because it was not in the printed bill. But, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I apologize. We will provide you, and should have done so already, with a chart showing you the existing fee and the change and the total. I apologize for not having that in front of you right now.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. My concern and my sensitivity is to the impacts that you have on business in Oregon when you continually raise fees, because those fees go right to the people that are having that, to the add of the cost of doing business. And I know in your recent presentation that he just gave, you say that you're sensitive to that, and yet you're asking for fee increases throughout, which is the impact to doing business. If it doesn't cost the business itself, that fee gets passed on, and it costs Oregonians more money to do business with those people. And I think we're at a point with our economic development in Oregon that we are just striving to attract business here and to help retain the business that we have. So I would truly like to hear your response to this 50-15.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, what you see in the bill and what you see every biennium is the fee increases, because that is the process. You do not see the fees that we don't change, and you do not see the fees that we decrease. But I can assure you that those are active parts of our work as well. We do have over 500 individual fees. And just this biennium, for example, we reduced two of the fees in the insurance area, the agent exam fee and the agent the single license fee and the dual license fee, for a total saving for Oregon businesses of over $100,000. We reduced the workers' compensation premium assessment for a total saving for Oregon employers of over $10 million. We reduced the workers' benefit assessment for a total saving for Oregon workers and businesses of almost $7 million. We reduced, on a one-time basis, some of the fees charged in the finance and corporate securities area for banks and credit unions for about $430,000. So, but each of our fees is dedicated to a specific program, so we can't move funds from one to the other. So there are certain occasions, and you're hearing about them today because we are required, and we should be required, to bring the fee increases to you. You're hearing about that small number, which, in order to maintain program or provide program at a level that we think is minimally acceptable, would require an increase. What Mr. Lanter has also described to you is the impact of choosing not to approve the fee increase, which is, of course, an option for you. And our concern is that we believe that in those small number of programs that we're bringing to you today, it would lead to unacceptable service levels.
One more question, one final question. Corey, go back to your $10 million figure that you just gave me. Who benefited from that?
Every Oregon employer, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger. That is a reduction in the premium assessment, which funds the workers' compensation and Oregon OSHA programs. It is paid by every Oregon employer to support those systems, and so we that is probably the fee that we charge that has the greatest impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's your method for allocating your central support staff? I assume you folks contribute a little bit to that. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, we have a chargeback plan, and we'll be happy to describe it in detail if you like, but those central costs which can be allocated specifically program by program are allocated specifically program by program. So, for example, if we have collection costs or billing costs or information technology costs that are program specific, they will be allocated directly. There are some costs which cannot be allocated directly, and those are allocated primarily on a per FTE basis.
Would it be possible for this committee to get a copy of your chargeback process?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
We could get that to all the committee members. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have in our letter file provided a letter regarding the Cemetery Association of Oregon, and they are supportive of the fee increase, but they've made a recommendation that it try to be better balanced. Now, was that discussed and I just happened to be buried in the paper up here, or
so
is that...
Speak.
Pardon?
So to speak.
I was buried in the paper.
The cemetery guy's on.
Oh, so...
Get it?
So
yeah. It's a great comment.
Okay, great. Well, some speak, some don't. But anyway, if I may read it into the record, however, many of our members simply feel that the fee structure is unfair since no matter how many trusts are written, parentheses, some cemeteries only write 15, while other cemeteries may write over 150, in parentheses. Yet everyone gets charged the same fee. We would strongly encourage the department to revisit the method of calculating the annual fee.
Chair Smith, Senator Morris. That is an issue that we continue to grapple with. For example, in the mortgage lending area, we talked about mortgage lending, consumer finance, and pre-needs here this morning or this afternoon. With respect to mortgage lending, we did try to make the fee structure more equitable by charging a portion for the number of loan originators that these folks employ, because they are driving the cost of the division. With respect to consumer finance, the feedback that we got when we participated with our stakeholders in these discussions was the same thing. Can the short-term lenders be charged more since they're driving the volume of the predominant volume of activity in the program? And as you see in that letter, with respect to pre-needs, they would like to see a more equitable fee structure, and I concur with that. That takes time. We have in that area a program review planned in 2005, and that's one of the issues we plan to address at that time. But it does take time to do the studies, get the stakeholder input, and develop the structure so that it's equitable, because we want to maintain consistency in these fees. We don't want to have the up and down cycle all the time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's exactly the response that I was hoping for. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if there are no more questions in this area, I'd like to move on to the worker leasing program. I'm sensitive to your time.
Well, I think we're going to move to invited testimony and then bring you folks. Isn't that what the agenda says?
Mr. Chair, we do have another piece to the fee bill, and I think that's what Ms. Streisinger is talking about. There's the piece to the fee bill that also involves building codes.
And one worker compensation program.
Is that what you
mean? Yeah. And then,
why don't we do that?
Then
I apologize. I was trying to stay on schedule.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. We'll try to move very quickly through these next two pieces. The next one, I'm going to ask John Shields to come up, and this is one of the piece that Senator Verger inquired about, the fee proposal for the worker leasing program. And so, John, if we could go through that very quickly, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Shields, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. We are requesting an increase in our licensing fee that we charge to worker leasing companies from $1,250 every 2 years to $2,050 every 2 years, effective July 1st, 2005. This is an $800 or 64% increase. Worker leasing companies provide workers to client employers for permanent work. They're employees of the leasing company, and the leasing company charges a fee back to the client employer, that, as well as providing the employee, they provide workers' compensation coverage and typically human resources support, payroll administration, unemployment, etc. The worker leasing concept has been a great benefit to employers here in Oregon, especially small employers, and I think the statistics I'm going to give you speak for themselves on that. In 1994, Oregon had 27 licensed worker leasing companies, and in this year, Oregon's total is 108. By the way, in 1994, that's when the original $1,250 fee was set. We have a current law that requires the worker leasing company to obtain a license from DCBS to be a leasing company, as well as requiring us in terms of our regulatory oversight. Our main concerns, regulatory concerns are that if a leasing company goes bankrupt or, frankly, abruptly leaves the state, and that has happened, that results in the client employers losing large sums of money, often deposits. We're also concerned with identifying leasing companies that may not be complying with the law. We want to create a level playing field for other leasing companies as well as other employers.
How does oversight over a leasing company help ensure that they don't go bankrupt and leave the state?
Mr. Chair, what we do in terms of oversight is to consists of a couple of steps. We do more than just maintain a registry, which is, you know, the list of licensed leasing companies, but we perform on-site audits of the leasing companies. We have an expanded licensure review where we take a look at the finances as well as whether or not there has been any criminal activity in the background of the individuals who are running the leasing company, for example, embezzlement or fraud.
So when you're doing the review, is it it's an annual financial audit?
Mr. Chair, we do an initial review for licensure, and then the audits are done on a cycle of every year is the cycle that we're on now. We just started the annual audits in 2003.
Walk through this with me. What's an initial review comprised?
Mr. Chair, the initial review consists of whether or not the leasing company should be licensed.
I'm talking about the financial initial review.
Mr. Chair, the financial review is basically consisting of, and I'm going to have to give you a very high level because I don't have a lot of the details with me today, but basically we go in there and take a look at the leasing company's assets as well as how long they've been in business, their client list, and again, whether there's any criminal background. And I would be glad to provide a better and more detailed answer for you if that's not sufficient.
I think I would need that because I'm not sure assets and client list would help me to determine whether a company is going to go bankrupt.
Mr. Chair, we can provide that. We can provide you with more detailed explanation if you'd like.
Questions? Are there any bonding requirements for these companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm going to have to get back to you on that question. I think I know the answer, but I hesitate to give you the answer and then find out I was wrong. I'd like to get back to you on that.
I've got to ask the question. How do we provide oversight if we don't know that answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we have currently one employee that provides the oversight for the worker leasing companies in the state of Oregon. This fee bill would be to continue the one employee.
Then I have a couple of questions. You said that there's annual audits on 108 companies. Are you saying that this single employee does annual audits on each of these companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, over the last year and a half, we've actually run a pilot project where we augmented the auditing capacities with another employee because we were taking a look at whether or not to come in with different recommendations. We worked with the leasing industry, the worker leasing industry itself, about a variety of options of how to handle that, and it was the consensus of our agency as well as the worker leasing company industry to continue with the approach that we have, which is an expanded review of licensure and the on-site audits.
How did we fund that other employee?
At this time, that employee was funded from our premium assessment operating account on a pilot basis.
Contracted employee? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, no. As a regular employee, a compliance specialist employee, the statute requires us to fund our regulatory activities from fees charged directly to the worker leasing companies. We were working with the worker leasing companies to try to determine what was the best way to regulate that industry, including going to no fee at all and going to something called a multiple coordinated policy approach that some other states use. As part of that process, we piloted the idea of having additional staff involved. Based on the results of the pilot and discussions with the industry, we have come back and are recommending just to stay with the one FTE.
So in your budget narrative where it shows the different agencies, the agency chart, but am I able to see that position in there? Or is this a self-financed position that we don't know about?
Mr. Chair, this is not a standalone program. It is one FTE within a larger program. If you'd like us to show you where in the...
What I'm frustrated with is an earlier comment was, is the fees fund the program. And I understood there was one person. Did fees from somewhere else pay for another person?
Mr. Chair, what we did over the last year...
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is yes on a pilot basis only.
Where did those funds come from?
From the premium assessment operating account, which funds the workers' compensation programs at large.
So who paid for that?
All Oregon employers pay that premium assessment.
Thanks. One final question I have. The reason I asked about bonding is... I know that it's important for regulatory agencies to take their regulations seriously, but auditing every business every year would be actually a very expensive process if your definition of auditing is the same as I would understand by auditing. And if they are bonded, then why would you need to do that?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I doubt that what we do meets your definition of a financial audit. We're primarily out there making sure that they're in compliance with the Oregon administrative rules that pertain to worker leasing companies, primarily maintaining of records. Have they identified their clients, for example, so that we can... Our primary concern is that the employers that they are covering have workers' compensation coverage. The worker leasing company is extending coverage to those client employers. So we want to make sure that those client employers, the list of those client employers are accurate, and that those workers who work for those client employers, if they're injured, are going to be covered by an employer who has workers' compensation insurance. Mm-hmm. So that's the primary thrust of our audits.
Okay. This is an employee leasing company, right? They have employees that they lease out to various companies. And so you have a company who has employees, and it's pretty easy to find out if that company has workers' comp on its employees. The reason this whole line of questioning began was, you said, we need a fee increase because we have to do certain things like basically assure that we don't have employer leasing companies that leave town or leave the state and leave employers high and dry. And so then we led into how do you do that, and we do audits and those kinds of things with one person. And so it kind of all comes around to if you've got 108 companies and they all have workers' comp insurance policies on their employees, then that's taken care of. That takes about a day to determine that. Maybe periodically check to make sure that they don't cancel those policies. And if your audit is really defined as basically just they comply with some questions, then why do we need a fee increase? I guess it comes all the way around to how complicated is it? Does it need to be that complicated? And if it doesn't need to be that complicated or it's not that complicated, then why do we need the additional money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there's really two things that we're looking at. You have the worker leasing company themselves that has their own employees, and yes, we can. It doesn't take a day to check the 108 worker leasing companies to determine whether or not they are carrying workers' compensation. Each one of those 108 companies has a list of client employers that they are furnishing employees to.
Yes.
What we want to make sure, one of the things we want to make sure on our audits on an ongoing basis is that they are maintaining accurate records and making sure that they are covering those client employers with their workers' compensation coverage, that is extended to those client employers so they are not being left without workers' compensation coverage. The second area is in the...
Oh, I'm sorry, but I'm confused. If the employer leasing company has an employee and... that's me. I've got this. And you're a company, you say, hey, I don't want to buy comp on this, or I don't know if I really want to keep this person or not, so I'd like to have them hired through you, you know, because it's a way for me to get a feel for it without having to deal with hiring and then terminating. I know lots of reasons for doing this. And so I then say, great, we make a deal, and I'm going to pay, you're going to pay him $14, you're going to pay me $14, I'm going to give him $12, okay, so I have my spread. Are you saying that you want to make sure that through me and my records that more than just this person is covered, but that all the other employees that you might have are covered? Because if I'm the employer leasing company and he's covered, he's covered. So I'm not clear on what it is that you're seeking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the situation would be, I think, this way, that if you are the employee, the worker leasing company,
right,
and I may be bringing in a crew of, let's say, 10, 15, 20 employees to do something for me.
I provide them to you.
You are providing those employees to me. You may be providing employees to a dozen employers or companies out there. What we are trying to do is to ensure that you are keeping the adequate records so that your coverage is extending to those other companies.
John, are you saying, for example, that you're accurately reporting the number of workers that you are sending so that you are not purchasing employers for 10 employees, or you're not purchasing coverage for 10 employees while actually you're sending out 50?
Yes.
So that in fact, your coverage matches your client base.
Yes, and secondly, that the accuracy of that reporting can run into large sums of money in terms of there is, without some oversight of this industry, there is a lot of room for people to hide a tremendous amount of cash flow that. For example, in Corey's example, reporting to the insurance company that we're extending coverage to 10 employees doing a light hazard occupation when in reality they're extending coverage to 60 or 70 employees in relatively moderate to heavy hazard occupation, and that makes a big difference in the amount of workers' compensation insurance premium they're going to pay.
Just really quick, hiding cash flow is bad.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't catch it.
Hiding cash flow, that was the term he used, is bad.
Mr. Chair, probably, I guess, the to be real blunt about it, just making sure that the worker leasing companies are accurately reporting the coverage that they're extending is what's important here. We want to make sure the workers are covered. We want to make sure that the employers are covered, as well as that the insurance companies are collecting the premium for the risk that they're covering.
So, and then I'll go to Representative Richardson, then Representative Verger. Thank
you. Okay, I'm XYZ Services, and the call center needs 10 people. So I send 10 people out to the call center and they're hired. But I don't cover them with workman's comp. I cover 5 of them and hope the other 5 won't do. What is my punishment for that? What is my, now do I pay a fine? Do I no longer get to be a services company? What happens to me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the ultimate punishment from us, so to speak, would be revocation of the license to be a worker leasing company in Oregon. There are also other labor charges that employer might be liable for.
All right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So my chances of being such a high risk and not covering these employees, because actually, you'd put me out of business if you took my license. So wouldn't that be just slim to none that I would do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, one would think so. However, I can think of one case in the last couple of years where there was upwards of $10 million worth of insurance premium that went unreported in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I might also add that I know that at least one of our witnesses on the invited testimony list is from the worker leasing industry and can give you the industry's perspective on that as well.
I follow up, please. Mr. Chair. I guess I'm curious why you doubled your fee, however.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the program without the fee increase would be 0.6 FTE, a part-time person. The fee increase would enable us to keep it as one FTE. The reason it's a large dollar amount is there are a very small number of companies. They serve a very large number of client businesses, small businesses, but there is a small number of actual worker leasing companies to pay the fee, so the dollar amount of the fee is larger than, for example, a plumbing fee where we might have thousands of people in the industry.
I'm confused. What was the workload factor, though, that allowed you to take the position from somewhere else and move it there?
That's a lie. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand.
I understand we moved an employee over to the pilot program. There must have been a workload factor consideration to determine how you were going to take an employee out of workers' comp and move it over here.
Mr. Chair, we reduced our FTE count in the workers' compensation division by, I think, 5.5 FTE this biennium. So we did have,
to the E board with, because this sounds like a self-financed reclassification, and I'm just curious, did you come to the E board then? To let us know you were going to move a position?
Mr. Chair, we work those through the Department of Administrative Services. There is not an e-board. Under current law, there is not a requirement that we come to the e-board with those, but we do have very strict requirements to work with the Department of Administrative Services for reclassification.
Would it be possible to get us just kind of a list of any self-financed reclassifications we've done over the last 2 years?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would just like to add that what we were doing was in response to the industry coming to us and asking for more regulation of the industry itself.
Representative Richardson.
Kind of final question on this that I have is I'm not sure why it is incumbent on you to be assuring that SAIF or Liberty Northwest premiums get paid. It seems to me like that would be an issue that the insurance company would be really concerned about, and they would pay that out of their own overhead instead of having it come out of yours.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that's an excellent question. The predominant place where these companies find their coverage is in the residual market or the assigned risk pool. Most worker leasing companies are not finding coverage in the voluntary market. So they're finding their coverage in the assigned risk pool. The assigned risk pool for the servicing carriers, they don't have the same financial risk there.
Just so I'll understand this, who regulates the assigned risk pool? Is that something that's within your umbrella of responsibility, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm very sensitive to the time. The fee bill includes some building codes fees, which are revenue neutral.
Come on up. What the heck?
Good afternoon.
Howdy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long. On the House Bill 5015, my fees that I'm going to talk about are on the first page and then the first four lines on the second page, just so you have a sense of what we're talking about. And this is going to be a difficult issue for me to explain, and I'll try to do it quite quickly. This is a regulatory streamlining effort for us. We had a request from business to take a look at our fees, the number of fees we charge in trying to calculate a plumbing permit, and to reduce those so that it would be simpler for the business to know exactly what the fee would be, it would be predictable, and it applies only in our jurisdictions. As part of this process, we worked with rulemaking committee, industry group, went through the board. I took about a year to a year and a half to do this simple, relatively simple exercise to make absolutely sure we were revenue neutral and that anything that we did would not increase costs or create a problem for businesses. I really look at this as part of, and you may remember, committee, many of the things when I did in the very beginning overview around regulatory streamlining, working on a variety of different projects. This is just one of my ongoing projects to try to make it simpler for business to operate, and I need you to approve this so I can kind of continue on. And from my perspective, it's really a pilot. We put this together to see if merging fees like this would work, and I hope that then it'd be a guide for the rest of the jurisdictions. Many jurisdictions in the state have multiple pages of fees when related to plumbing permits, and we simply went from one page with very small print and lots of numbers to one page with larger print and not so many numbers. And we think that that'll be easier for our contractors to figure out what a permit costs, and when do they need one, and how much the appropriate fee is. And with that, that's exactly what we're doing. I think I have a difficult job of trying to explain to you why something on a fee bill is not a fee increase, but that's what I'm attempting to do, and that's why I'm here. It's really about something else, and I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Okay. Any questions? I thought that was fairly clear. I'm looking at the budget narrative agency summary organizational chart, and it indicates that building codes division for 0305 was at 150.74 FTEs, and that for 0507 it's 143.75. What caused that reduction?
Mr. Chair,
I want to commend you for it, unless they just shifted someplace else.
No. Not related to this particular issue.
It isn't. But
our staffing was reduced, and it's in our package. You have it there. We reduced by 7 positions, 6.3 FTE, in the electrical, elevator, manufactured structures, and RV programs. And the reason why is because of revenue declines in those program areas, and I need to bring expenses in line with revenue. So not related to this particular issue at all. And then specifically to the electrical programs, and I don't want to bore you with too many details, we provide services where cities and counties choose not to. Every year, certain cities and counties choose to assume programs from the state. This last biennium, we lost some electrical programs to other counties, and it's appropriate to give up those staff when that occurs. Okay?
All right, well, just one final question is the fees that you charge, how do they compare with those that are charged by local jurisdictions?
Mr. Chair, my fees are always in the bottom half of the 130 jurisdictions around the statewide, and we continually look at and receive information on where we're at, and we're always, if you look at the state as a whole, 130 jurisdictions, we're always on the bottom half of the equation, which is fine, but frankly, then I'm expected to provide services in areas that are on the upper half of the cost because it's in remote areas of the state where our inspectors drive significant amount of miles from job to job to job to job, frankly, because local governments have chosen not to carry out the program in those areas.
We appreciate the good example you set, Tim.
Thank you.
No, just before you leave,
I would ask you to maybe further explain to the committee why some local governments decided to turn it over to the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, there's a couple reasons. First and foremost, my hope is that through local administration of program, you know, local services are typically carried out best at the local level. Okay, we try to do the best job that we can, frankly, providing local services through a management structure in Salem and having field offices out in the area, but that's not the most efficient model, but it's the model that I am required to carry out. So one of it's basically more local services. Secondly, it's to kind of combine the planning, designing, community development, building codes, kind of coordinate all those issues in kind of a one-stop shopping. So many jurisdictions will try to get all those pieces, and if the building codes piece is done either by a county, if it's a city, or the state, you know, in our case, we try to coordinate, but you know, it's more efficient when you can walk right in there and talk to every single person that has to deal with construction over the counter. And so that's why it occurs, and it changes every year. Jurisdictions put in their requests, and we analyze that, whether it's a city wanting services from a county, or a county or a city, typically a county wanting services from the state, and we work with them on that. So,
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if there's a few minutes at the end, we'll be back to answer questions.
Perfect. Perfect. I think now we're going to go to public testimony.
Invited testimony first.
I'm going to bring up someone first.
Okay.
There's a reason. We're going to move into public testimony. I'm going to ask Mr. James Bella, would you like to testify? We'll give 5 minutes.
Representative Smith, members of the committee, I came Thursday because you told me I could have more than 5 minutes.
How much time would you like?
Well, I hope you ask some questions, but borrowing a line from Michael Greenfield, I'd be very, very...
Really quick, if you just give your name for the record,
James,
and let's do this. We're going to give you till a quarter after. I have a whole bunch of folks who need to testify.
James Bela. Do you need my address?
Nope.
I live in Portland, Oregon. Borrowing a line from Michael Greenfield, I would be very, very wary of appropriating any state general funds to any agency ending in BS. I'm here today to testify that this is surely the worst agency in state government and thereby deserving of the last place in line for state funds. The greatest transgression is their deliberate and premeditated trashing of the public's access to statutory requirements. What we're experiencing and what the agency is committed to in regard to public safety in the face of the very large earthquakes we now know without a doubt are in our future, exactly like the December 26 Sumatra, Indonesia earthquake, is a kind of management by litigation. They will only adhere to statutory language in terms of state building code safety regarding earthquake design provisions when challenged by lawsuit. Basically, this is the issue. Honey, I shrunk the codes. We have a very different building code than across the river in the state of Washington and a very different building code than we have in California. Therefore, I'm recommending and kind of protesting that no funding should flow to DCBS and through them to BCD till the legislature holds hearings on the state and adequacy of Oregon's earthquake building codes. What will be found will be the decade-long systematically weakening of the earthquake design provisions of model building codes when those national standards become adopted in Oregon. When we face the magnitude 9 subduction zone earthquakes off our coastline, how can we justify a different earthquake building code than as adopted in the states of Washington and California? We can't. I've given you a pretty complete tour through this debacle, propagated mostly by the administrator of the Building Codes Division, but with the full knowledge and complicity of Director Streisinger. After the big earthquake, when state regulators and enablers will be held accountable, not even Director Streisinger will be able to talk fast enough to get out of the fact that state agencies have deliberately set aside the earthquake safety of Oregonians, particularly those living closest to our Cascadia subduction zone coastal community. The CD-ROM that I've given you gives you code-specific examples of the changes that were made in Oregon's building code. Um, case I run out of time, I want to draw your attention in the packet. There's a this is an actual code change. It has to do with wall anchorage. And this is an anchor bolt which holds your sill plate down in your house. Prior to the Northridge earthquake, the building code has these round half-inch washers. After the earthquake, there was a lot of damage to sill plates that split, and it was discovered that one of the reasons this happened was people were over-drilling the holes. And so after the Northridge earthquake, it was a code change was made that you had a, it's called a bearing plate washer. It's 2x2x3/16. The present code now, it's been upgraded to it's now 3x3. So it clamps this sill plate down very effectively. The 25 of these in a $300,000 house add about maybe $3.60 to the cost of the house. I could not buy these in Portland. They told me they're not even required, so I had to go to Vancouver to require to see them. So this is kind of the chiseling that we're doing to our building codes in Oregon. And these are supposed to be required in the Willamette Valley, but they're not. And the major issue is that the Oregon Building Code is systematically an alternate method, that the code allows you to use an alternate method, but you must show equivalency. And so all the materials in here, we have this, this is a seismic zone map, and the areas in pink are areas that require higher design standards in the model code, but Oregon omitted those. There's Milton Freewater had an earthquake in 1936, 6.1 or 2, and knocked a locomotive off its track. So just, and there's a lot of issue on the seismic zone. That's the higher strength that's required in the coast. Senator Verger, are you from Coos Bay?
I am.
Okay. Well, Coos Bay got a new hospital, and it was built to a seismic zone 4. But over the this upgrade in Oregon's building code had to be brought by public citizens, and this standard that the coast should have a higher seismic design has been known since 1995 when ODOT did a seismic design mapping state of Oregon.
Share with me really quick, where did your passion for this issue come from?
I'm an earth scientist and a geologist, and when it was thought that we had a subduction zone but it didn't have any earthquake, the geologic or science community pretty much was accepting that by the late 80s, but there was no acceptance in the engineering and kind of political legislative arenas. But
share with the committee, where did your instruction come from?
What do you mean instruction?
Your educational background.
I have a master's degree in geology and a master's degree in civil engineering, geotechnical or soil mechanics and foundations. So I just, after the earthquake, I know what's going to happen. It's not going to happen in the state of Washington, but we're going to It's going to be not only embarrassing, but very, very expensive.
Have you tried to work with the department through this issue?
Well, that's why I've given you this packet. There's no basis for their denial of code changes, and there's even there's no public allowed on the committees. Actually, that's the funny thing is that the reason we got the seismic zone was that the vision used to, anybody could show up and be a code change committee and have a vote. And the committee denied the change to Zone 4, but at the public hearing, the hearings officer said that the evidence favored Zone 4, and his name was Tom Higashi. So after that happened, the clamps were put on, and only people appointed by the building codes could be on the committee. It's really a broken system.
Johnson. Mark, come on up. Come on up.
I know he's listening to every word of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that we've discussed from time to time in this committee is the business climate in this state and the cost of doing business in this state. And I was just curious whether or not any of your materials, as I understand from your testimony, you're urging building codes that would require seismic upgrades to all buildings. Have you done any analysis on the increased cost to building to people building buildings and what kind of a chilling effect that might have? I don't discount the issue that you're raising, and all of us saw the hideous results of the earthquake at Christmas time, but I'm just trying to figure out whether or not you've done any cost analysis with respect to these very stringent requirements and the chilling effect on business in the state.
Well, there is no chilling effect, and the information that was presented back in 1997 when the new maps came out, California has seismic zone 3 and zone 4. They've had it for years, so they know the cost of building in Sacramento, which is Zone 3, compared to San Francisco. It makes very little difference in new construction. You just have a higher design strength. And I submitted stuff to the public hearings of these California studies. They gave you the cost per square foot. And it's in the cases of the HVAC system is more expensive than the increased earthquake resistance. Or I put in terms of carpeting. Carpeting is more expensive than putting in the earthquake. You can't put it in after the fact. And we're talking about codes for new construction. And they, after delaying it for a decade, when the new maps actually showed a decrease on the coast, they said, well, you can use the new maps as an alternate method, even though those maps haven't been approved to be with the International Building Code yet. That happens in the fall. But
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Bela, thank you for coming in. Obviously, you have a great background, and that this is something that's very important to you, and you're going on the record as warning Oregon to these concerns. Is it correct that what you would like to see, you have several things, but one is that you believe that in Oregon we should have a 3 by 3 inch, you know, 1/4 inch by 3 by 3 plate to hold down the sill in our building code. Is that one of the suggestions you've got?
Well, we should use the model code. The state of Washington has 14 amendments to the residential building code, and we changed everything. I've given you, if you look at that CD, you can see everything that's been chiseled out. My issue is that there's no statutory justification for what is being done in Oregon. It's just people vote, but you're supposed to give scientific justification. And that's why I gave you in the front of this.
Okay,
book.
Well, Mr. Bay, because of time, you know, you've given us a lot of information to digest, and we have Mr. Long here, who's over the building code. So you've got the right people you're talking to. We would like to have him give just a little response as to what he knows And then what we'd like to do also is to look into it further and then get back with you as to why we've made the decisions, speaking collectively as the state of Oregon, that we have. Would that be acceptable to you, that we first get an opinion today based on, you know, this is something that's rather new to the committee, and then we get back with you later?
Certainly, I mean, Representative.
And we can't change the world in one meeting, but you've brought this issue up. You've given us a lot of data. And so, Mr. Chair, my recommendation is that we give Mr. Long an opportunity to respond, and then we get back with you with a more detailed response later. Thank you. Mr. Long, welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. What's the question?
The question is, why would Oregon have a building code that is less protective against earthquake than California and Washington, both of which have followed the standardized recommended earthquake code?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, what I might do is just help you. We adopt, in my overview, you may recall, I have seven boards that advise the Building Codes Division on issues of licensure, permit, code, standards, a variety of things. As a matter of fact, there's relatively little that we do without either a board or public input or some one of those types of things. And in codes in Oregon, they go through all those boards, excuse me. And on those boards sit engineers, architects, designers, fire officials, building officials, public members. I think I have 80-some board members that overall through these seven different boards. The code-making process is 14 months. The boards go through that deliberative process, taking in all the information that is submitted both by the division as well as by outside sources, and then they make a recommendation to us based on the scientific and technical aspects of the recommendation. They also have to look at fiscal impact on a broader basis, and then specifically for residential construction, a specific housing cost impact. All that gets flushed out over about a 14-month period. It comes to me. We try to figure out if it's consistent with state policy, and then we go into public hearing, take additional testimony, and adopt it. So,
nature of time,
yeah.
Would you obtain for us so that we can also provide it to Mr. Bela, information on the earthquake codes? We have the information here, mm-hmm. that he's providing, and his position is that there has been recommendations that Oregon implement a more rigid earthquake code, and we've chosen not to. And so we'd like to get back with him with an answer as to why we've made that decision.
If you give me a few days, the stack of material is quite large, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson. So I'd be happy to do that if it's we're very aware of the issue, and we'd be happy to provide you. There's a variety of different interests and beliefs about these kinds of things that
there's
be difficult to debate here.
Then is he mentioned that there's no citizen involvement on these boards, and you've indicated that there may be some confusion there.
Mr. Chair, not only is there citizen involvement statutorily, there are citizens that sit on the board. So
okay.
I assume those meetings are open to the public.
Mr. Chair, they're open to the public. We conduct. I can't tell you the number of meetings. One of the reasons why I actually enjoy coming here, believe it or not, is because we have on any particular day in building codes or any particular month, several board meetings, several committee meetings, several public meetings, probably 15 or 20 a month. So it's something we're very used to doing.
Are you on the mailing list for those meetings?
Well, the issue here is these code changes were submitted under building codes division staff. They had meetings with what they call stakeholders that they were not announced as public meetings. They took all what they wanted in the code, and then they put this weakened code language that was submitted by the Building Codes Division as the code changes for Oregon. So the Building Codes Division is submitting the code changes, and then they get to approve them at the end.
Here's what I'd like to do. One, I want to make sure Mr. Bell is notified of all meetings. As an Oregonian, you have a right to attend any and all of those meetings. Second is I would ask that you would submit to me a list of the recommended changes. And then I would like to submit those, and we'd get a response back. Is that fair?
Well, what's on the CD is not complete because I didn't have enough time, but what's on the CD were the weekend changes in Oregon. I submitted them to the National, so you can see what the weekend changes in most of the cases in Oregon are.
Thank you very much. Thank you. In the interest of time, we're going to have to move forward, but if you would provide that, could you? Okay.
Mr. Chair, just for clarity, will I wait to get something from you on
yes.
the specifics
yes.
you'd like to respond? Is that okay, Representative Richardson,
yes.
as well? Thank you.
I just want to make sure he's notified of meetings and the ball will be in.
He's notified of meetings.
Thank you. Okay. All righty. Let's go to Jim Marquis. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Marquis. Today representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, the Oregon Collectors Association, Surplus Lines of Oregon, and Community Loans of America. Those are the four clients that I have that are regulated by the Department of Consumer Business Services. With all due respect to the previous speaker, I would have to say that my experience has been exactly opposite of his with respect to this department. Over the past 30 years representing people in this building, I've dealt with a lot of state agencies. I believe this state agency to be head and shoulders above most that I deal with and most that I've dealt with over the years. I say that also knowing that Corey Streisig and I have disagreed on issues. We have testified against each other on more than one bill this session, but that's appropriate. She's the regulator and I represent the regulated, and we don't always agree. Today, specifically, I want to speak to House Bill 5015 on behalf of my clients that are regulated by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We have worked with Floyd Lanter, who I believe to be a great administrator, in this process on fee adjustments within programs. One of those program adjustments is in the Consumer Finance Program, which one of my clients is regulated under. And that fee goes from the present $375 to $520. Our clients support that increase not because they like to pay higher fees, but because they were part of a process. Because we sat around a table, we did a program review, we looked at the numbers, we looked at what the department was doing in terms of regulatory activity, and our clients felt that the increase was appropriate for the level of activity that was required. With respect to the Mortgage Lenders Association, we went through a similar process that resulted in a fee increase, and I'm here to support that fee increase, too, on behalf of them. Again, there was a lengthy process prior to the legislative session where I sat down with my clients, the mortgage bankers. The mortgage brokers were there with John McCauley, their lobbyist, along with the department personnel, and we went through the numbers. And I have to say that there's been some concern raised, I believe, by Mr. McCauley's clients over this fee, and I do want to emphasize that he and his clients were part of this process and agreed to these fees, and these fees were primarily driven, the increased cost of regulation was primarily driven by legislation that was passed in 2001 at the request of the mortgage brokers. Senator Johnson was fairly intricately involved in that process because she was on the committee that dealt with that legislation that created registration of loan originators. These are loan officers that work primarily for mortgage brokers. When we passed that legislation and we helped work on the legislation, we looked at estimates of how many loan originators would be registered under that program. They don't pay for the registration, but the department has processing costs and keeping track of them. We estimated 3,000 to 4,000 would be registered under that program, and the numbers rose to 12,000, in excess of 12,000. A lot of those out of state. It was free to register, so why not? Some of those people were doing business in Oregon and some weren't. Additionally, you have to realize that in the mortgage lending industry, it is a volatile industry. We have many more mortgage companies today than we had several years ago when interest rates were higher. We got a lot of people that have been living off of refinances and those sorts of things, and some of those people are going to go away. So as we try to make projections into the future, it's hard to do because there are a lot of variables. One of the cost drivers of this program has been complaints against loan originators and the registration process that was created by the 2001 legislation. So what we did in this program was to change the system of fees from a simple so many dollars per company to so many dollars per company plus a $60 fee for each loan originator that was that worked within that company. And we think that system is going to go well, but we worked we operated on some assumptions that we're going to lose about 40% of those loan originators in that registration process. So the agreement that we have with the department is that these fees will be reviewed at the end of the year and adjusted again, and that's the process that we'd like to see to continue. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to ask that Joseph Bluebaum. We have nine folks we have to get through in 28 minutes. I'm going to ask if you could keep your comments to about 3-4 minutes.
I will do that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Bluebaugh. I'm CEO of TNT Management Resources, which is a licensed worker leasing company here in Salem. Been in business 13 years. I am also here today as a member and representative of the Northwest Professional Employer Association, which is an industry association representing many of the worker leasing companies here in Oregon. My comments, and I am here to speak on behalf of the fee increase, and I know during some of the discussion there may be a couple of questions, but I'll enter my comments and then entertain any questions. I think will be the quickest. We have enjoyed as an industry the opportunity to participate with the department in a work group where the industry is represented, a number of the work comp carriers active in this market are represented, as well as Department of Revenue and employment and affected agencies and so forth. We support the increase as a necessary increase to support what we view as a minimum acceptable level of staffing for the statute as it exists today. And our statute is one that deals with evidence of coverage. A worker leasing company joins with a client to employ all of their workforce and become responsible for workers' compensation as if it was their own policy, rather than a temporary type agency that would assign a portion of the workforce or on a contingent or short-term basis. So that being the distinction, the department and the auditing, the compliance auditing that we've seen is not financial auditing, but compliance auditing that these client companies are being added from an evidence of coverage procedure. We are involved in discussions with a number of the members of the industry or the regulatory work group and believe there are some opportunities to streamline the evidence of coverage procedure and make it look more like the traditional market, and that may afford the opportunity for streamlining in the future, which would reduce program cost and potentially the fee basis. I'd like to thank the department for the relationship that they've had with us. We're not happy about paying more fees, but I will say that our experience is as the last presenter had said, our experience has been very positive, and we are satisfied that the right choices have been made in coming up with this fee agreement. And I'd entertain any questions.
How'd you hear about today's hearing?
We have been very involved with the department in this process, and they asked us very, very early on to be involved with the legislative process. We offered a letter on the January 19th, and I trust it's been in your packages. I'm happy to leave it behind as well, but I think I heard it referred to earlier. And so we've you know, consider it both an opportunity and a responsibility to be involved in the process.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Ruva, I thank you for clarifying that, because I was under the impression that this was a little bit of a different situation than what you're describing. And so the worker leasing companies provide all coverage for all employees of a client company.
That's correct.
Do you also do bookkeeping and payment of wages and all that, or is it merely a workers' comp thing?
It is, I'll speak for the common example. We are responsible for the administrative duties of being an employer. Our client retains the day-to-day direction and control of the workforce and so forth, typically makes hiring decisions and sets pay rates and so forth. We actually do payroll, benefits administration, those sorts of things that relieve the small to medium-sized employer from keeping up with that portion of the administrative business burdens.
Perfect. So, thank you.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to ask Burton Weiss to come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Weiss. I'm here on behalf of Local 290, Plumbers and Fitters. I want to very quickly speak to House Bill 5015, and Mark Long already referenced what the issue was. You can blame me and my fellow plumbing industry people for this bill. 2 years ago, we approached the division and talked about we were getting concerned about the ever-growing list of things that you had to look at to determine what your fee was for a plumber. And I'll give you a short personal story. My father operated Brookings Plumbing on the South Coast for 50 years, and I have distinct memories of my mother sitting at the kitchen table in afternoons going through plans, going through the code book or the local governments, because some was done by the county, some by the state, and some by the city of Brookings, going through the book, just trying to figure out what to make the checkout for to get the permit. And it really was almost a full-time job for my mother to do. And this is multiplied all over the state by plumbing, small plumbing companies. Big plumbing companies have people who do nothing but this. This is their sole job, is to figure out what the permit fee is and then go stand in line to actually get the permit. So what we were after here is, why do you have to count hose bibs? Why do we have to count every faucet? Why do we have to count all of these things to determine a fee? So this was a pilot effort to see if we could get this down. And we think this is going to be successful, and we worked very hard to make sure that it didn't add any increased revenue. It was revenue neutral, because if this works, we want to be able to go to all the local jurisdictions in the state and say, it's not necessary for you to have a person spending an hour checking to see if a fee is correct. There's a better way to do this, and this is how it'll work. So that's what this is about. The plumbing industry asked the Building Code Division to do this. We work very closely with them, and we would very much urge your support of House Bill 5015 in the plumbing portion.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you for very compelling testimony. You said two things that intrigued me. The first one was somebody sitting there figuring out what the fee was and then going down and standing and waiting in line. If we pass this fee bill, I think we address the problem of the first part, sitting there figuring it all out. Is e-government at all responding to the going and standing in line part?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we hope so. That's another initiative we work closely with the department on, is getting e-permits. We've had some success with that in the Metro Portland area. We have bigger jurisdictions, have bigger budgets, and are able to adapt to the new technology. But we're hoping that within a couple of years, or a few years, we'll be able statewide to be able to get permits through e-permits. And we've been very appreciative of the legislature's support for that effort last session in passing a bill to help us set that up. So, yes, we hope the line situation will be helped by the e-permit process. Right now, a lot of jurisdictions let us fax in permits, and you can also do an account. Most jurisdictions allow you to do an account. So we've been making a lot of progress on the line part here over the years.
Follow up, Mr.
Please.
Chair. Actually, it's a two-part follow-up. I think as some of us are struggling with looking at budgets that include e-government, any lists that you could provide to the legislature where you show areas where there could be continuous improvement might be helpful, and I just suggest that there could be portals to enter the legislature with your recommendations. And second, apropos a question posed by Senator Morris yesterday to some of the invited testimony asking for ways to improve the business climate in Oregon, any thoughts on where else e-permitting, e-government might be useful to the people you represent, I think would be helpful.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I'd be pleased, and if I can speak so on behalf of all the industry folks who are here, I think all of us would be pleased to. They're all nodding their head here. We've talked a great deal about the e-permit process, and I think we'd all be very glad to try and provide information, and I think we all have some ideas on how to improve things. Last session, we passed a Senate bill that kind of set up a process to deal with the e-permits. I know the state, I think in May of this year, the state went online with a lot of their permits. We've really made dramatic progress in that area, and the legislature's been very supportive. The Building Code Division and DCPS have been very supportive, and we'd be glad to give you other ideas where we think it would work.
If you'd allow me one more comment.
Yep. Yep.
I just hope, based on what you said about the bigger jurisdictions have more money and are able to embrace the e-government process better, for those of us that represent places like Coos Bay and Heppner and Nehalem,
Scappoose,
we worry about that stuff too. And I just hope that you and your urban brothers will keep the rest of us in mind as you're urging the agency forward.
We will do that, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you.
It takes one of our sisters to
yes.
brothers of mine. Senator Berger, and we've got to move on.
Would you tell me the percentage of increase that you're asking on your fee increase?
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, to the best of my knowledge, there is no increase in this plumbing. It is just a change in the way we assess the fee. I use the example of my mother, who's still alive, so I hope she doesn't hate me for this. But anyway, use example of where she had to count fixtures, do all kinds of crazy things to figure out the fee. With this bill, she doesn't have to do that. There's a base fee, and it's very simple to do. But at the end of the day, we believe our best estimate is the amount of revenue raised under the old system and the amount of revenue raised under the new system will be the same. So there is no fee increase. We don't believe there's a fee increase in this.
Burton, really quick, Jared Broadfoot shared a joke with me, and I don't understand it.
I'm not sure how to,
can you help explain this? He was asking me, what do you call a plumber that can't finish the apprenticeship program?
It's an electrician.
Oh, he told me it's a meat fitter.
Yeah, no, it's an electrician. Trust me.
I didn't know. I just thought that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jared, you're up.
Very good, Mr.
That was good, Greg.
Now that I've been thrown under the bus. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot, and forgive me for the long list, but it's absolutely important to the folks I'm here representing today. Here today representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the National Electrical Contractors Association, and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, in support of House Bills 5014 and 5015. Let me start by responding, Mr. Chair, to Senator Johnson's one of her comments and questions. The construction industry, first of all, has been working very hard with the Building Codes Division and DCBS on e-permitting, and we have to say they've done a fantastic job of listening to us, listening to contractors throughout the state, and then moving forward with our concerns, a way to take e-permitting statewide. For those of you in the Senate, we've got a bill that was passed unanimously out of the House, House Bill 3097, that allows the Building Codes Division to take e-permitting statewide. And it's our idea that we can start in actually the more rural parts of the state to implement that, because it does not make much sense for a contractor to have to drive 200 miles or 100 miles to pull a permit. He should be able to do that over the Internet. So, and the second part of that is a bill that's actually in this committee, which would be Senate Bill 421, which we would like to see building codes folks out in the regions of the state to deal with conflicts between contractors and building officials. And that bill actually does have the support of the building officials and the contractors, and we're just trying to make it easier for our folks. And the Building Codes Division has worked very hard to do that.
Well,
so people
what was that bill number again?
Senate Bill 421.
Okay.
Or the DOA thing we were talking about.
I haven't heard that number yet.
Drawer, so.
To continue my testimony, and very briefly on House Bill 5015, Mr. Chair, we echo the comments of Burton Wiest, and we were involved in that as well, and feel that the agency responded very appropriately. And that's a pattern that the Building Codes Division and DCBS has established with the industry across the board, is they've been extremely responsive to the needs of consumers, contractors, and workers. The dedicated funds that they receive from our contractors and workers stay to be spent on those programs, and that's very important to us. The budgeting process is extremely transparent. The Building Codes Division and DCBS spent a year and a half meeting with our clients individually and other folks within the industry and local jurisdictions to explain how they were budgeting and how those dedicated funds were being spent on those programs. It was very good for our clients to get that personal interaction with those folks, so we're very happy about that. The customer service they're receiving in the field has improved substantially and continues to improve. Don't let me leave you with the impression that there's not room for improvement, because there is, and I've highlighted a couple ways we can do that, but from the construction industry standpoint, at least the parts that we represent, Building Codes Division and the Department of Consumer Business Services has made great strides, and they continue to impress us every single day. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
What would be some of those areas of improvement that could be made?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, like I said, we'd absolutely love to see e-permitting go statewide and to be fully funded. It's obviously going to cost money, and the contractors are working very diligently with the Building Codes Division to figure out how we pay for a system like that, to make sure that no matter where you're at in the state, you can pull permits. And in the end, at the end of the day, once that program is fully implemented, even submit plans and call for inspections online as well. Additionally, like I said, Senate Bill 421, where we can have folks in the field that do basically conflict management, and not as a reaction, but a proactive conflict management, so that we can have good relationships with contractors and building officials throughout the state, because it's a lot easier at a local level to have those issues dealt with, as opposed to having someone from Salem come down with a hammer or an iron fist and make decisions. It's a lot easier to have those issues worked out in local jurisdictions. So those are just a couple examples. I could continue, but in the interest of time.
I'll hold it in the interest. I'll get to you later, Chair.
Yeah, we know how to find him.
Yeah.
He knows how to find
him. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
Local 290, that's what we're
talking about. Thank you, Jared. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask that John Powell, Tom Gallagher, and Lisa Trussell all come up together. Is Lisa in the room?
Lisa, no, she's not here. I don't think.
Oh, okay. Lisa has a letter for us.
Sorry.
Nope. We have two more people after you folks, so why don't we split this, and if each of you could take about 3.5 minutes, if that'd be okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You want to go first?
No.
My name is John Powell.
Use my hands.
My name is John Powell. I represent various clients that are regulated by the insurance division primarily, and in all lines of insurance. So I've been very familiar with not only the history of the funding of this agency since it became basically totally fee-funded, because I was a member of the legislature when I think the last general fund was pulled out of that in the last recession in the early 80s. So I wanted to just talk about a couple things that the agency does well. And the first one is conflict resolution. You people get letters from time to time from somebody who believes they were not treated properly by an insurer or the system. The insurance division
through compliance officers and the complaint mechanisms, resolve tons of those types of issues every day. And many times it's misunderstandings, sometimes on the part of an insurer, sometimes on the part of the consumer. But they do a credible job. They do that well. I think they could use some more training and probably more dollars in that sense. The other thing that the insurance industry relies upon is the overview of the agency on the solvency of insurers. We're in a competitive business that can lead to the reduction in rates in a competitive environment that can lead eventually to insolvency. And so the industry relies upon the agency to be a check and balance in that system. And it's a very tough line. It's very difficult for a regulator to almost tell a company they either can't lower their prices or they better not lower their prices or they will be on a watch list. So I think they do that well. There's a debate now in this country over whether or not that should be a federal, whether insurance regulation should be governed by the federal government. I just don't understand how it would work when I see this up close daily. I just don't know how a federal agency could replicate. I know they couldn't with the same number of dollars what this agency does. And finally, I would simply say that I do remember when the insurance industry agreed to the fee assessment system that eased the general fund from paying for its regulation. I also remember quite vividly representatives of that industry before the Revenue Committee that I chaired saying, now, we've got a deal here. We're going to put up these dollars, but these dollars go for this purpose. And that was the deal, I remember, in 1981. Don't grab these dollars and start using them for some other purpose. So I'd just leave you with that and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Urban Developers Coalition and Portland Business Alliance. I want to give you another view of the agency because my folks aren't directly regulated. In the same sense that we're going through insurance or workers' comp or the other aspects with the agency. I got involved with this agency through the issue of regulatory streamlining and permit streamlining. I don't just mean building permits. I mean the bigger permits for larger developments. And I was I served on an interim committee that was set up by legislation in the last session with the committee, or headed by this agency. And I want to say that I think that they are looking at the fee bills that you're looking at here, I think this agency is looking very hard at finding new and better ways to regulate. And I think in a lot of ways they're on the cutting edge of it. I want to point out two things that the agency is doing different. It's strategic management decision making that comes from the top that tells these other agencies and some of the stories you've heard here to take a good hard look at how they're doing their business and whether they can do it better or cheaper. And secondly, I think they have a very good small business focus. What is not in front of you, and what I did early part of the session, was talk about House Bill 2188, which is now down in Ways and Means. They have the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which was set up in this department by governor's order. It is not a statutory body. I think it is probably one of the most important functions they have right now. And if I could just, in referring you to that bill, look at what we put in that bill as directions for that department. They are to research and provide advice to state agencies on the impact of proposed rules. And one big part of the rule is the fiscal cost to the regulated community and finding other ways that you can achieve the same outcomes and objectives at cheaper costs. There's no statutory direction like that inside of government. In Section 183 or Chapter 183 of Administrative Rules, we try, but we don't get there. Another direction is to reduce the cumulative impact of rules on small business. That takes a lot of inside knowledge to find and to work across state agency lines and department lines and division lines to reduce the cumulative impact of rules. Streamlining regulatory permitting and processing. That's a bumper sticker in this state. We don't have anybody inside of state government, other than a couple of people in this agency and department who really worked hard at looking at this. And increasing administrative flexibility and regulations. That's what you talked a little bit about in terms of using permits and so forth. Taking emerging and new technologies, which has a piece of legislation on it, and figuring out how to start regulating an area without crushing it under the cost of regulatory burdens and so forth. I want to come back and point out to you that most of the problems don't just come from the actions of bureaucrats. They come from the policy directions and statutory directions that you guys have given them. And there is no policy in place to start taking a look at those again, except in Section 5 of 2188, which says...
You're talking about Ben, right, from that statement?
I was just trying to figure out which of Mr. Gallagher's bills are still alive at this point.
And soon won't be.
That's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. He was not
a nice guy.
Everybody knows that.
Mr. Chair, I'll let the Senator defend himself. In Section 3, it says that this department is supposed to research those statutes and come back and tell you where you could change policy directions to complete streamlining and overview. Let me leave it at that, which is to say that bill sits down in this committee. There's some thought about because of stripping out this section so that it doesn't have to go through Ways and Means. I don't like that. I think that's something you should look at. I recommended in the interim to actually put in a position for small business because the bigger businesses are pretty well protected. Workers' comp has got competent people. Insurance has competent people. The hundreds of thousands of small businesses have J.L. Wilson sometimes and somebody else sometimes, but they don't have anybody inside of state government who on a day-to-day basis is looking at the rules and regulations done by other agencies and saying, hey, guys, have you thought about how this is going to impact that small business? So I think there's something very positive that you can do in this area. Thank you.
What was the bill number again?
2188.
Thank you. All right. Nathan Phillips.
I don't know. I have this draft, but I haven't read it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips. I am been an electrical contractor for about 25 years, an electrician for about 35. I'm the governor of the Oregon Pacific Cascade chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association, and I'm a citizen volunteer on one of the advisory boards at Building Coast Division. I'm currently the chair of the Electrical and Elevator Board.
Quick question, Representative Richard.
I just have a quick question. What do you call an electrician who doesn't make it through the apprentice program?
Well, after the hearing, I'll tell you the difference between an electrician and a plumber. I wouldn't want to do it on the record. I'll tell you that.
They call them senators.
I've been very supportive, and actually I think I speak for the electrical contractors, the NECA members around the state, of the very open and inclusive process that we've seen at DCBS and BCD over the last several years. The budget process at BCD has been completely overhauled to match expenses and revenues, and since we're a fee-based program, that's very important to those of us who pay the fees, that the expenses are matched to them. And the process is transparent and understandable, and in the past it was not that. It was pretty convoluted. The code adoption and development process has also been a very open and inclusive process, and I personally have been involved in the electrical code, but I also participated as a citizen in the development of the new building code, which you heard about earlier. The change from the old uniform building code to the new national international building code is a national sea change. It's caused a lot of controversy, particularly the earthquake protection provisions are very controversial. The NECA nationally is looking at efforts to moderate those changes. What occurred in Oregon was that the national new model code was amended to make it more consistent with the existing code so that it was somewhat of a cost-neutral change from the old code to the new code. And I can tell you as a contractor that these earthquake provisions the complying with these earthquake provisions is not a trivial low-cost matter. It's extremely costly and has a very complicated cascading effect on the cost of construction for all of the trades that have to work in these buildings. So I personally was very supportive of the way the new building code was adopted. I thought that it was a very inclusive process. I certainly had no problem giving input into it, and I think that the outcome was a moderate approach, and that we will see over the next several code cycles as this international building code becomes refined some of these changes.
The question I have is, are we safe?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in earthquake code, but I think that there was a very broad participation. I saw lots of people give input, and there were people all over the map in terms of whether they thought this was appropriate or not, and the consensus was that it is.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm satisfied that it was a consensus, at least. Now, one of the things that's happened in BCD that Senator Johnson was talking about that has been pretty exciting is the innovative use of fees in our programs, particularly in the e-government area. We were pretty excited that when the online licensing program went live, the first license that was available online was for electrical contractors. And over the next several months and years, we'll be able to renew and apply for all of our licenses online, which is a great benefit. The e-permitting pilot that you've heard about is also involves electrical permits in the Tri-County area, and it is going live just in the next couple of weeks, and that will be a great benefit all over the state when that becomes a statewide program. BCD has also been innovative in implementing programs to promote statewide consistency in code interpretation and local government processes, and you've heard about that a little bit from Jared. So I guess just in closing, I've been involved with BCD and observing them for about the last 20 years, and this administration has never been better. We're very supportive of them and like to see their budget approved. Any questions?
I wonder how old Jared was if you've been doing this for 20 years.
Clearly wasn't born yet.
Thank you very much. We have one last individual to come up, Walter Haskins. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a lot of what I'm going to say is a ditto of what Burton and some of the other people have said. I'm speaking for BCD.
Just introduce yourself really quick.
Yes. My name is Walter Haskins. I'm Vice President of Morgan Cascade Plumbing and Heating, Inc., which is a plumbing and heating company in the city of Salem. I am also a member and president of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors. The Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors membership and my company wholeheartedly support the Building Codes Division's budget. BCD has made strides, which they've talked about today, in streamlining, and we believe this is going to make it easier for us to do business and with our customers. It's going to be a very good thing for our industry as a whole. My understanding is in the plumbing fee area, they reduced it from 22 to 10 categories on that form that Mr. Long showed you, and which will help us calculate the permits. And the greatest benefit this consolidation provides is that it enables us to predict with certainty the fees that we're going to charge or be charged for a project. But we hope that this consolidation of fees will be able to be used in other jurisdictions also as a guideline to help the whole entire industry with the permit process. So that's all I have. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Do you know of any contractors who are opposed to the fee increase?
Well, first of all, we don't see it as a fee increase.
Okay.
From the information we have. But I haven't talked to anybody that's a contractor that's opposed, whether they're electrical, mechanical, plumbing, or whatever. So, but it's for us, it's reduction of red tape, more user-friendly, easier to do, less confusion. In the past, it's just like Burton said, you could set down five contractors, give them the same job, have them figure the permit out, have them go down to get their permit from whatever agency it was, and all of them, they would tell you it was different than what all five of you did. So we're hoping this helps.
That's powerful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just very quickly, is there anyone else that we missed. With that said, then I guess we are going to close our public hearing for the afternoon, and we will be adjourned until Monday.
Mr. Chair, if I could just point out to that witness, the light's dimming significantly. There was not a comment on your testimony.
Or an electrical contract.
No. It's testimony on Gallagher's bills. You know, I mean.
It'd be nice if we had a building official here to make sure we had power.